It's really a marvelous pleasure for me to be here tonight on behalf of Peter Lawford's brother-in-law. And I'd like to be half of Peter Lawford's brother-in-law. And if perchance Mr. Kennedy is the next president of the United States, we'd be very happy to make... Let's not lose our heads. We'd be very happy to make Puccini's the summer White House. And it dawns on me that while I'm standing here, this close to Jack Kennedy, in this very hotel on the 8th floor, Vic Damone is sitting with Dick Nixon. And it's an 8-5 bet. It's a staring contest.
Our guest of honor is both a politician and a statesman. A politician is necessarily preoccupied with means. A statesman must also be concerned with ends. Jack Kennedy's brilliant record reflects an understanding of ends, of the high purposes to which a great democracy must dedicate itself. He combines this with a grasp of political tactics in a way which has won him the esteem of the American people. The Democratic Party is indeed fortunate to have leadership of such stature. Jack, it's a pleasure to have you here in California again and to have you with us on this great occasion. Now, the chief political pastime these days is speculating about the presidency. Except among the newspaper fraternity where everything goes, it is really not quite proper to ask someone who is prominently mentioned as a candidate if he intends to run. The interrogator is rarely that blunt. He uses the oblique approach. Who, he asks, do you think is out in front? Will so-and-so run? What do you think of Governor so-and-so and his chances? Now, Jack, I've watched you on television, and I've read about your press conferences, and I don't know just exactly how you answer those questions. But I found the answer in one of the weekly stock market letters which dispense advice to investors. It's very, very useful, and it goes like this, and I'm quoting, "There has been some unsettlement, followed by weakness in several of the coincident indicators. A resistance level will be encountered, and it will generate a rebound followed by an upsurge. The upside potential will find a support area, and then the advance will be resumed." End of the quote. Anyone who can make anything out of that ought to hire himself out to our counterintelligence and be put to work working on breaking the Russian codes. And Senator Jack Kennedy, you're free to use that formula when I'm not using it. Now let me say a little word, and my talk tonight is very brief, about these Jefferson Jackson Day dinners. They are more than fundraising events. They are more than merely ceremonial. And I don't want to detract from those two purposes in the slightest degree. These dinners tighten the bonds that tie us together because they celebrate a noble tradition, the noblest tradition to which a party can be dedicated. Jackson's favorite phrase was fresh from the people. Jefferson was called an atheist, a leveler, an anarchist, and a demagogue. But the vocabulary of vituperation needed a more abusive epithet, and his detractors at last found one. They called him a Democrat with a small D. There weren't large D Democrats in those days, but we Democrats are proud to have that label stand for the small D, too. If Tories shrink from disparaging a candidate as a lowercase Democrat these days, this is because you at this dinner, the Democratic leadership in general, generations of Democrats who have preceded us, and Democrats everywhere have taught them to honor the demos, the people, even if they do not serve them. Jefferson and his rival Hamilton, Jackson and his rival Webster, are all dead. But the great issue over which they contended survives them. Shall government serve the rich and the well-born, or shall it serve the people? So stated, the issue seems so simple, but in its application it is so much more complex. I encounter it, I assure you, every day as the chief executive of this great and growing state. When we're forced to find new revenues for significant public services, shall these bear more heavily on high-income groups or middle- and low-income groups? When the state spends money, shall it use it to subsidize some special interest or to raise the standard of public service for all of our people? Shall employers enjoy an absolute right to hire as they please? Or shall government limit this right when it is exercised capriciously against older workers or workers of darker skin? Shall we leave the average consumer to the mercies of a market where commodities are packaged and labeled and sold under conditions which leave him baffled and confused? Or shall government stand with the consumer, the forgotten man of our modern economy? Shall interest rates be manipulated to suit the purposes of the moneylenders, or shall government scrutinize interest rates in behalf of the otherwise hapless borrower? Shall government tolerate a slowdown of the national economy, or shall it seek the full realization of our productive potentialities? Shall public leadership stand by and allow our productive resources to go, whatever frivolous uses hidden persuaders draw them, or do public leaders have a moral responsibility to use counter-persuasion on behalf of schools and highways and health and housing? Shall we allow a chromium-plated materialism to be the principal apparent goal of our national life, or do we not have a responsibility to muster a new national conscience, a new sense of public purpose in the face of this challenge that we see all around us by the Soviet and by the scientific achievements that they've made? And two, do we not have to look at the rising expectations of hundreds of millions of people in the world? There is no doubt about how the followers of Jefferson and Jackson will answer these questions. There is no doubt, I hope, how you think that I would answer them. And I haven't the slightest doubt as to how Jack Kennedy will answer them. That is why, Jack, beside our very warm personal regard for you, that we're happy that you're with us tonight. Thank you.
It is, as I indicated, an honor to introduce our speaker of the evening. The noted historian Arthur Schlesinger, Jr. recently said, "It has been well said that the great natural resource of the Republican Party is money, and that the great natural resource of the Democratic Party is brains." The man who we have here to address us this evening personifies Schlesinger's description. Jack Kennedy has more than brains. He has brains and great personal and political courage. I would like to say that Jack Kennedy was elected to Congress at the age of 29 and went on, and incidentally, that was in the same year that Nixon was elected to Congress. What a distinction and a difference. Jack was reelected successively since then and eventually became the United States Senator from Massachusetts, where he defeated Henry Cabot Lodge by an overwhelming vote. To merely describe Jack Kennedy as a successful politician would not do him justice, as was said by our own Governor Pat Brown. Jack is a famous veteran. He's an author of renown. His book, Profiles in Courage, was not only a bestseller, but it was a Pulitzer Prize winner. Jack, in my judgment, and I'm sure in yours, and the judgment of every Democrat in this nation, is a great American, a great Democrat. He's a leader. And I want to say that regardless of who the president in 1960 is going to be, I know it will be a Democrat. I would like to introduce to you at this time the United States Senator from Massachusetts, Jack Kennedy.
Now, Governor and Mrs. Brown, Mr. Harvey and Mr. Evans, Mr. Paul Ziffrin, Mr. Sinatra, Mr. McLean, Mr. Martin, Mr. Saul, distinguished guests, ladies and gentlemen. It is, as you know, a great honor and distinction for a politician from a small state to come to one with 81 votes at the next convention. I am, as you know, a member of a horde of itinerant Democrats who are pouring across your borders at this very moment, who are coming to pay their respects to your distinguished governor, Governor Brown. It is an unfortunate fact that no expecting politician ever comes to Massachusetts and calls on us in Boston. It may be because we only have 39 votes, but I think it's really because Governor Brown has made such an outstanding record, and they want to sit at his feet for just a few minutes. Actually, I did not come here seeking delegate support. I actually came here trying to get a couple of tickets for the next convention. And last night, I don't think I'm breaking a confidence that Governor Brown offered me 60 delegates or 50 tickets, and I took the tickets and felt that I'd had the best of it. I have told Governor Brown on many occasions how fortunate he is to live here in the West, that he wouldn't possibly like it back East, that it's very unsatisfactory in many ways to live. And that there's no real reason why he should take a demotion by going back there instead of being the governor of California. Mr. Mort Saul made some references to bigotry. And the presence of Governor Brown and I here at the head table may bring to mind to many of you what happened to another great governor when he became a presidential nominee. Despite his successful record as governor, despite his plain-spoken views, his campaign was a complete failure. His views were distorted. He carried fewer voter states than any candidate in his party's history. He lost states which had been solid for a half a century. And to top it all off, he lost the state of which he had been a great governor. You know his name and his religion, Alf Landon Protestant. not prepared, however, to say that a Protestant should not be nominated in 1960. It is a great honor for us to come together tonight to pay tribute to Mr. Jefferson and Mr. Jackson. But we should realize that neither of them were wholly beloved in their own day. For example, one prominent Democrat is quoted as saying in 1824, "I feel much alarmed at the prospect of seeing General Jackson president. He is one of the most unfit men I know of for such a place. He has very little respect for the law. His passions are terrible. He is altogether a dangerous man." This was the statement of Thomas Jefferson. And who do you suppose it was when Mr. Jefferson was president who described him as too cowardly to resent foreign outrage on the Republic? A man willing to seize peaceable Americans and prosecute them for political purposes. A man who seems to hold himself above the law. This statement, of course, was made by the man who has been enshrined in the memory of this country by the Democratic Party. It was made by General Andrew Jackson. I quote these two statements not to demonstrate that they were both wrong, because they both were wrong, but because I think that it indicates a most important characteristic of the Democratic Party, a willingness to speak out, to say our piece. Senator Beveridge, who was a distinguished Republican, who later became disenchanted with his own party, once said, "A political party is not an Indian tribe united by blood. It is a group of men and women who are joined together by a common aspiration for the future." And this very quality of Jefferson and Jackson, their thoughts about each other and about the future and the past, are the very things which make them the intellectual fathers of the Democratic Party today. It seems to me that in the 1960 election, as Paul Ziffrin said, that we should take into that election words which were spoken by Franklin Roosevelt in 1936 before 100,000 people as he stepped before them at Franklin Field to accept the nomination. Just before he was about to step out on the stage and just before the curtain parted, while leaning on the arm of his son Jimmy, he slipped and fell. The Secret Service picked him up, the curtain parted, and he made one of his most confident and buoyant speeches. In that speech, he said, "Governments can err. Presidents do make mistakes. But the immortal Dante tells us that divine justice weighs the sins of the cold-blooded and the sins of the warm-hearted in a different scale. Better the occasional faults of a government that lives in the spirit of charity than the consistent omissions of a government frozen in the ice of its own indifference." It seems to me in the United States in the last 7 years, we have come very close to a government frozen in the ice of its own indifference, and I do not look with pleasure upon going through another decade of it. And therefore, I think this election is most important. This contrast between the Democratic Party of today and the Republican Party was noted in 1933 by the new president's friend, Robert E. Sherwood, who wrote a brief sardonic poem, "Plodding feet, tramp, tramp, the grand old party's breaking camp. Blare of bugles, din, din, the New Deal is moving in." Today, on every major crisis, stretching from Formosa through Asia and Africa and up to Western Europe, we see no new ideas, no bold action, no blare of bugles, din, din. We see only plodding feet, tramp, tramp, and the grand old party breaking camp. It seems to me, therefore, that it's vitally important that in the next 12 months that lie before us and the election of 1960, that we bring to the American people the real issues that face this country. That we do not go to them with the slogans of peace, prosperity, and progress, which are only slogans which shield the fact that the relative power and standing and prestige of the United States has declined during the last administration. The fact of the matter is that the president and the administration that we pick in November of 1960, most likely, history tells us, will be the president and the administration that will be reelected in November of 1964. So when the American people choose their next president and their next Congress, they should remember that they're choosing their future, and that in those 8 years, the face of the world and the face of the United States will be changed. And the fact of the matter is, as they now know, that the party of memory in this country is the Republican Party, and the party of hope is the Democratic Party. And it is in that spirit we should go. The fact of the matter is that at the end of the second term of the next president, there will be 10 million more children in this country who are in need of a decent education. The fact of the matter is that this administration has not met this problem as well as the problems of outer space. And it can be said about this generation, if this continues, that the words of T.S. Eliot in his bitter poem, The Rock, "And the wind shall say, these were a decent people. Their only monument, the asphalt road, and 1,000 lost golf balls." The fact of the matter is that during those same 8 years, the Soviet Union will also be moving ahead. By the year 1975, the Soviet Union will have a greater hydroelectric capacity than the United States. By the year 1985, the Soviet Union will be outproducing us if we continue at our present rate of growth and if they continue at theirs. By the year 2000, the confidence which Mr. Khrushchev showed during his trip to the United States may well give him control of the world. After he visited us and looked at us, he went to Peking and said, "The capitalistic system is a sick and dying and faltering horse that was about to collapse into the ground." I think his most alarming characteristic was his sense of the inevitability of the success of his system. Now, things do not happen, they're made to happen. I think this election is as important, in some ways more important, than the election of Roosevelt in 1932. Because in 1932, freedom in this country was at stake. In 1960 and in the next 40 years, freedom is going to be at stake all over the world. Lincoln said this country could not exist half slave and half free. This world cannot exist half slave and half free. And by the year 2000, we're going to know whether it's going to be free or slave. And it seems to me that the function and responsibility of the United States government as the great defenders of freedom here and around the world makes it essential that the Democratic Party take office in 1960. Finally, I would say that the real issue, it seems to me, perhaps even beyond the differences which separate us from the Republican Party, is our conception of the qualities of self-discipline and restraint, which are also part of the discipline of self-government. The fact of the matter is that we face in the next generation a hard, tough course for perhaps a generation or more. And the fact of the matter is that as a nation, we are in danger of going soft. We are in danger of losing our will to prevail and endure. We are in danger of forgetting our traditions. The slow corrosion of luxury, the slow erosion of courage, is manifested in a dozen different ways. Nearly one out of every two Americans are turned down by the draft board today as physically, mentally, or morally unfit to bear arms. This is perhaps only one phase of a national decline. But the results of this one phase were tragically revealed during the Korean War. American prisoners of war stretching back to the Revolution, and most especially the Civil War, had a great tradition. And yet in Korea, nearly one out of three Americans collaborated with the enemy, and one out of seven engaged in propaganda broadcasts or in spying on their fellows. It seems to me that we must recognize that if this country and the cause of freedom is going to survive around the world, if we're going to demonstrate that we follow the road to the future, that the communist system is as old as Egypt, that it is a backward and most harsh and restrictive system, that it seems to me that we must recognize the burden upon us all. I would say that communist atrocities in Korea accounted for some deaths.
But 38% of American prisoners of war died in that struggle. And yet of 251 Turkish prisoners taken to war, not one died. And what was true of the Turks was true also of the Colombians. Not a country which most of us in South America feel to be very advanced. I would therefore say that the things which are happening to us in the last decade under this administration, the failure to set before this country its unfinished tasks, the failure to explain to the people the business that this country must engage in, not only here but around the world, it seems to me all this calls most basically and most importantly and significantly for a change in our national direction, a change in our national leadership. It seems to me that the next generation is going to face the hard test of whether a free society, with its range of alternatives, its individual freedoms, whether that system can successfully compete with the communist domination and its monolithic controls. Can a free society endure? Have we the nerve and the will? Can we carry through in an age where we will witness not only new breakthroughs in weapons of destruction, but also a race for mastery of the sky and the rain, the ocean and the tides, the far side of space, and the inside of men's minds? We and the Russians now have the power to destroy all of the world with one blow. And it is the great issues, it seems to me, in space and in this country and around the world, to which the Democratic Party must address itself during the next 12 months. During the Korean War, a young American was called out of the ranks by his Chinese captors. And they said to him, "What do you think of General George C. Marshall?" He said, "I think General George C. Marshall is a great American." He was hit by the butt of a rifle and sent to the ground. And then they picked him up again and they said, "What do you think of General George C. Marshall now?" He said, "I think General George C. Marshall is a great American." This time there was no rifle butt, because in their own way they had classified him and determined upon his courage. It seems to me, as individuals and as a nation, we also are going to be called out of the ranks in the next 10 years, and we too must give the same affirmative answer.